it's from a movie or from a book or from an audiobook. Stories have been a part of our race since we were created. We love telling stories. But one thing that I really hate is spoilers. Spoilers to a good story. If it's spoilers about the plot ahead, or if it's about a plot twist coming, or if it's about the ending, I'm wanting to go see a movie or read a book, and before I do, someone tells me what is going to happen. And for me, it feels like it robs me of the experience, and I'm pretty sure some of you feel the same way. There are a few rare individuals I've met, maybe one who doesn't really care, but I care because I want to experience the surprises as the author or as the director intended. I want to feel the tension building in the story. For example, I don't want to know if the hero is going to win. I don't know if the villain's going to win. I want to be surprised. I want to be invested. And I feel like when I am spoiled an element of the story, it takes a part of that away. Now, ironically, though we may hate spoilers and stories, we often want them for our own lives. One of the things that causes perhaps the most anxiety is uncertainty. That's not something we really like. We prefer to know what is going to happen, even if it's good or bad, so we can at least prepare for it ahead of time. The coronavirus is a good example of this. There's a lot of uncertainty in the air. You know, we don't know when our economy is going to go back to normal. We don't know when we can go back to work as normal. We don't know when we can have friends over and be social and shake hands. There's a lot of uncertainty, and that creates a lot of anxiety. Now, of course, in times like this, and in any time of uncertainty, we know this is where we trust God as Christians. We trust His promises, and we reflect on what He has done for us in the Bible, what we have seen Him do in the Bible, and what He has done for us in our own lives. Now, the reason I bring up this idea about spoilers is because when we read the Bible, sometimes it's difficult for us to be empathetic or to be sympathetic to those whom the Bible talks about because we know the end of the story. We might be like, well, this person's a slave right now, but two verses later, he's free. So we're not too worried about it because we know their end. Well, they didn't. You know, for them, they lived lives just like we do. They didn't know what was going to happen, especially in the story of Joseph that we're going to continue today. As far as he knew, he was a slave for life. And when he becomes a prisoner, as far as he knew, he was a prisoner for life. And yet, in light of not knowing his future, whether it would be good or bad, he was obedient in every way. And so let's consider that as we continue his story. If you'll turn with me to Genesis chapter 39. We left off last week with him being sold into slavery by his brothers because of their jealousy and their anger toward him. He was sold to some Midianites, also called Ishmaelites, and they brought him to Egypt, and they sold him to a man named Potiphar. Let's read Genesis chapter 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. Now we see he's sold to a man by the name of Potiphar. He was the captain of Pharaoh's bodyguard, likely making him a prominent official. His job was to protect Pharaoh and to punish criminals. Since he was likely a prominent member of the king's court, he was likely financially well off. Now, of course, the idea of being a slave was never pleasant, no matter what age you lived in. Now, in the ancient world, if you were completely destitute, sometimes it was actually better to be a slave because you at least had someone to provide food and to take care of you. But not for a boy like Joseph or a young man like Joseph. Remember, he was the favorite son of a very wealthy man. The last thing he would want to do is be a slave. But as we see in verse 2, the Lord was with Joseph. This is a phrase we find four times in the chapter. And no matter how bleak the story gets, we are constantly reminded by Moses that God is with him. We know that certain movies have narrators. I think Morgan Freeman is often considered one of the best narrators of all time. He's just really good at telling a story. He has a nice old voice that exudes wisdom and calmness and peace. He's just really good at telling a story. I've often heard people lament the fact that Morgan Freeman can't narrate their own lives. You know, if you were to have a narrator narrating your story, you'd want it to be Morgan Freeman. And if we could hear his voice in the background, whenever we faced a various trial, I'm sure we would hear the words, "The Lord was with Connor," or "The Lord was with Yvonne," or "The Lord was with Frank." And though we can't hear that in our own lives, we know that if it was true of Joseph, it's true of us today. And God was certainly with Joseph, and this is clearly seen in verses 2 through 6, if you will read with me there. The Lord was with Joseph, so he became a successful man, and he was great in the house of his master, the Egyptian. Now his master saw that the Lord was with him, and how the Lord caused all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph found favor in his sight, and became his personal servant, and he made him overseer over his house. And all that he owned, he put in his charge. It came about from the time he made him overseer in his house, and over all that he owned, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house on account of Joseph. Thus the Lord's blessings was upon all that he owned, in the house and in the field. So he left everything he owned in Joseph's charge. And with him there, he did not concern himself with anything except the food which he ate. Now, though Joseph was a slave, he still worked hard for his master. And it's very hard, as we can imagine, for someone who was once free to do the work of a slave. And yet he did it, and he did it well. And God blessed his efforts, whether through his providence or perhaps even from time to time through his direct intervention. But this was also clearly seen by Potiphar. Now, we know from verse 14 that Potiphar likely had many slaves and attendants in his own house. And yet, Joseph, who, of course, I don't know how long he was there at this point, Joseph was able to rise the ranks and become his favorite. And Potiphar sees how God is blessing him, and he makes him a personal servant, making him an overseer of the house. Basically, everything in the house, Joseph has authority over. And we see that Potiphar is even blessed in the process. There's a constant theme we find throughout Scripture where God blesses those who are kind to his servants. We see that here, and we see that also in Genesis chapter 12, verse 3, where God promises Abraham, he often promises him this, that whoever blesses him, God is going to bless, and whoever curses him, God is going to curse. And I believe that is true for us today as well. But as we see in verse 6, Joseph did not take advantage of his position. He could have abused his station as the most powerful man in the house. He could have mistreated those who were under him. He could have stolen from his master. He could have abused his influence. But as we see in verse 6, he only concerned himself with the food that he ate. He had this entire house before him, but he was only concerned with the food that he was given him. Now consider his former situation. He was the favorite child of 12 children, 11 of them his brothers. He was one of 13 children, 11 of which were his brothers, and he had a sister, Dinah. Now, he was the favorite. Now, I think we know what favoritism often breeds: selfishness and entitlement. And yet, we don't see that exhibited in the person of Joseph at all. He was humble, and he was focused on serving God and his master as well. Now, we see Joseph, while he's serving as Potiphar's main servant, he is tested. We see at the end of verse 6 that it says Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. We also see in Genesis chapter 29, verse 17, something similar is said of his mother. Moses writes that she was beautiful of form and face, so perhaps the genetics of Joseph were very kind to him, and indeed he was an attractive man. But as we see in verse 7, Potiphar's wife took notice of this. It came about after these events that his master's wife looked with desire at Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Now, with such a brazen command, this perhaps indicates this is not the first time she attempted to do this with a slave. But we see, in light of everything, Joseph was loyal. Read with me verses 8 through 9. "But he refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, with me here, my master does not concern himself with anything in the house, and he has put all that he owns in my charge. There is no one greater in this house than I, and he has withheld nothing from me except you because you are his wife. How could I do this great evil and sin against God?'" Now look what Joseph says. He says, "My master, trust me. My master doesn't have to worry about anything. I'm not going to violate that trust. The only thing he has kept from me is you, because obviously you are his wife. If I were to do this, this would be a great evil," and indeed it would. Now, this would have been likely a shock to her, since one, Joseph is unmarried, and perhaps being a slave may never be married. And second, in all slave societies, promiscuity was a common thing, so she would have been shocked by this display of chastity. But she, as we see in verse 10, would not take no for an answer. This temptation went on day after day. There is an old tradition that suggests that this lasted a year. Could be that, it could be less, it could be more. But nonetheless, she tempted him every day of his life. And finally, as we see in verse 12, she would not take no for an answer. She held on to his garment, and she said, "Lie with me." And of course, Joseph did just what any man of God would do. He fled from this temptation and went out of the house, leaving the garment in her hand. Now, he didn't go out without any clothes. Remember, he had a tunic, like a big shirt, and then he had a robe over it. What likely happened is she held on to his robe, and he slipped out of it like we would a jacket. Now, he did exactly as Paul tells Christians to do in 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 22, to flee youthful lust. And it reminds me of an event that I got to witness several years ago. When I did judo, I guess it may have been about 4 or 5 years now, there was a specific dojo I went to, and it wasn't in the best part of town. It wasn't a nice neighborhood, but the dojo was nice. Okay, the dojo was falling apart, but it had a good teacher and I had good people to train with, so I enjoyed going to it. On one particular night, it was about 8 o'clock, I'm heading home, and I see a man who's blind with his cane at 8 o'clock at night in the bad part of town, and he's nearly running down the sidewalk, walking very, very fast, nearly charging. And I'm like, okay, this is interesting. So, I'm not going to leave him here. So I go past him, I turn the car around, and I pull up. And, you know, they say when you lose one sense, all your other senses are heightened. And he hears the car pull up, and he's like, "Are you a police officer?" I'm like, "No, I'm just going to give you a ride." He's like, "Okay." I was like, "Would you like a ride home?" He said, "Yes, I would like a ride home." And so he gets in, and we're talking, and turns out he was a member of the Church of Christ. You know, I didn't even say it, but he was too. You know, he brought it up first that he was a member of the Church of Christ. And I asked him, you know, what are you of all people doing here in the middle of the night? He said, well, he met a new friend, they were hanging out, and things didn't go too well. He had some other friends coming over, and they brought out cocaine. And he said, "I'm an addict. And I knew that if I was to stay there, I was going to do drugs." And he wouldn't let me use the phone to go home, and so I thought I needed to leave. And you know, consider this, a man who was blind in the bad part of town thought it'd be better to be outside in the dark, defenseless, than be trapped in a house with his greatest temptation. And I thought that was so great because he literally did what Paul said. He fled from his temptation the same way Joseph did. Now, of course, as we see in verses 13 through 18, she does not take kindly to this. In verses 14 through 15, she gets all the other servants and makes up this story about how he tried to force himself on her. And she even plays the race card. She calls him a Hebrew. Remember, he's likely the only Hebrew in the house, and it's easy for her to use that to turn everyone else against him. And she even lies to her husband in the process. She almost seems to blame him, talking about this Hebrew slave whom he has brought to us. Now, as we see in verses 19 through 20, the anger of Potiphar burns. Now, it is interesting that it doesn't say that the anger burned against Joseph. That could be nothing. It could be insignificant. But it is interesting to see what happens to Joseph. He is not executed. You would think of a man who had that much power over someone else, especially being accused of harassing his wife. You would think that a man such as this would execute him. But instead, he ends up in prison, which is not a good thing, but it's better than being executed. So perhaps he had some affection for Joseph, or perhaps he doubted his wife's story, because it's odd that Joseph would not be executed, and instead he places him in prison. As we see from Genesis chapter 40, verse 7, this prison seems to be built into his house. It seems to be some sort of joint complex. Exactly how that works, I don't know, but it appears the prison was in his own house. Nevertheless, Joseph hits the low point of his story. He went from the son of a very wealthy man to a slave and now a prisoner. Now, if Joseph had any time in his life to feel a sense of despair, it would be now. And yet we see in verse 21, Moses reminds us that though the story looks bleak, He says, but the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him. Now, this time God also takes care of Joseph, as we see in verses 21 through 23. He gives him favor in the eyes of the jailer. And Joseph has a similar position, not as prestigious as it was before, but he is still given charge of the prison to tend and to keep it and to supervise over it. And as we see again in verse 23, and whatever Joseph did, the Lord made to prosper. We see from Genesis chapter 41, verse 1, that Joseph spends at least 2 years in prison. It could well be more than that, but we know it is at least 2 years. And as we talked about our introduction, it's hard for us to appreciate what's going on, because for us, it's only a matter of a chapter that we can read in 2 minutes. It's hard for us to get too anxious about it because we know what's going to happen afterwards. But Joseph didn't know that. You know, as far as he knew, he was a prisoner. As far as he knew, he was going to die there. He had no hope. He had no release date. He had no way to bond out of jail. This was his future as far as he knew. And yet, in light of this, he was still obedient to God. He still was the best prisoner a person could be. Yeah, I would hate to find myself in a place in life where I'm nothing but a prisoner and my only goal is to be the best prisoner. But nonetheless, that's what Joseph was. And he made the most of what he had. Now, as he spends time in this prison, as we see in Genesis chapter 40, verses 1 through 3, the baker and the cupbearer of Pharaoh are thrown into prison. Now, we might not think too much of cupbearers or bakers. We probably think of it as just a job. In fact, we don't even have cupbearers anymore. And bakers, if you're a baker, that's a good thing. Not too prestigious unless you're a really famous baker, but, you know, still it's nothing special in how we typically rate things. Never mind, I want to take that back because we have some really good bakers here, and you're fantastic and you're appreciated. But in comparison to royal officials, that's what I'm talking about. But in this time, they were very special. And in one sense, they were seen as the first line of defense to the king. You know, if you're trying to kill a monarch, you can lead a war against him, but remember, he has guards and soldiers. So the easiest way to kill a monarch or a pharaoh or a king is to poison them. And so the baker protects his food. The cupbearer protects his drinks. And they were seen closely associated with the king and probably also had an advisory role to the king as well. And for whatever reason, Pharaoh becomes furious with them. I hate to find out what they did, but apparently it was bad enough that they end up in prison. And as we see in verses 5 through 6, they both have their own unique dream. Now, as we talked about last week, dreams in the ancient world were seen as portals into the future, providing spoilers, if you will, for what was to come. If you were a person, a royal official who lived in the palace, you likely had dream interpreters on hand that whenever you had a weird dream, you could go to them, they could explain it, and you could know what was going to happen in the future. Of course, them being in prison, they had no way to access this. And on top of that, they're probably pretty nervous about their future. They don't know if Pharaoh is going to execute them. They don't know if he's going to leave them there. They don't know if they're going to be restored to their position. And they were probably feeling that their dreams had some key to their future, but they had no way of knowing what it was. Little did they realize they were in the presence of a man who was once called the Master of Dreams by his brother. And so we see that Joseph, of course, giving credit to God, says that he can interpret their dreams, and he asks the cupbearer to tell him his dream. As we see in verses 9 through 11, the cupbearer has an interesting dream. He sees a plant, basically a vine with three branches, and he watches pretty much the whole growth or production process before him. He watches it bud, bloom, finally produces grapes, and he takes these grapes in his hand, squeezes them into a cup, and he places the cup in Pharaoh's hand. Now, in verses 12 through 15, Joseph gives the interpretation. He says these three branches represent 3 days, and he said, and in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to lift your head and restore you to your former position. And we can also see how that applies to the rest of the dream. The cupbearer is doing what he used to do, placing his Pharaoh's drink within his own hand. Now, unfortunately, I'll get to that in a second. After Joseph gives the interpretation, he asks for a simple favor, that he can put in a good word for Pharaoh and that Joseph can be freed from his predicament. Now, unfortunately, the baker hears of this interpretation and he hears it's pretty good. He assumes he's also going to hear a favorable interpretation. But this is not the case. In verses 16 through 17, he sees basically three baskets sitting on his head with the birds eating baked goods out of them. And these baked goods were initially for Pharaoh. And it was a little similar to the dream. The three baskets also represented 3 days. Now, we don't have to be an expert in symbols to know that when there are birds, especially birds like this, it's never a good sign. Joseph says that within 3 days, the Pharaoh will lift his head, but in a different way. His head will be lifted from him. That is, he will be executed. And this bread almost acts as a fuse. Basically, when they run out of bread in 3 days, what are they going to eat? Well, they're going to eat him. And as we see in verses 20 through 22, everything happens as Joseph predicts. But he is forgotten for two more years. Now, how long was he in prison? It could have been far more than 2 years, but we know it was at least 2 years. Now, I feel bad because last week we left on a bad note, and now we're leaving on a bad note again. Last week we left with Joseph being sold into slavery. Now we end with him being in prison, but the story does get better. But let's consider a few things before we conclude. Perhaps you find yourself in a place where you're not meant to be. Joseph knew exactly how that felt. Remember, he was the son of a wealthy man. He was the son of Jacob, the son of Isaac, the son of Abraham, and to him belonged the wealth of the Abraham family and the promises of God. And yet he found himself as a slave and a prisoner in a foreign land. Though he was a slave, he was the best slave. And though he was the prisoner, he was the best prisoner. And whatever God placed within his hands, he made the most of it. God saw his servant, and he was with him the whole time. And whatever he placed within his hand, he made him prosper. Whatever is placed within our hand, even though it's inconvenient, even though it's not maybe what we want to do, even though maybe it's not even where we meant to be, we still have the responsibility to make the most of our life, even if we are placed in the situation as a slave or as a prisoner. And if God can work through the situation of Joseph, he can work with us. Perhaps you also find yourself faced with a daily temptation like Joseph did. Now, there are some temptations you can escape. Unfortunately, Joseph faced a temptation he could not escape. He lived in the same house with this woman. And even though that was the case, he created a lot of distance between himself and her. And when he was placed in a corner, he ran away, just as we should. We should also flee from our temptations. Now, this running away should not be seen as a sign of weakness, but as a sign of wisdom, knowing and being aware of our own weaknesses. Perhaps you find yourself pressed in at every side. Joseph knew exactly how that felt. Often the entire world was against him, but he knew that God was with him. Now, each of us are at a different place in our own story. Maybe it's the beginning of our story, maybe it's the end, maybe it's and maybe it's our darkest hour. Wherever we find ourselves in our own story, know that if God worked in the life of Joseph and providentially took care of him, we can know that God will take care of us in the same way as well. Now, before we conclude today, if there's anyone here who is not a Christian, I think we're all Christians here, but if there are any prayers you need in particular, we'd be glad to pray for you. If there's a particular temptation you're struggling with, or if there's a sin you have fallen into, we'd be glad to pray for you, and God will certainly forgive you or help you in any way that you need. And if you simply would like prayers on something else, we'd be glad to pray for you, and we know that God will hear and help us in our trials. If there's anything we can do for you spiritually today, please come forward as we stand and sing.